Hi, I'm Ellie Carter from Extended, and if you've been enjoying our podcast, we really need your help. We need a few moments of your time to review Extended on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast player. A 5-star review would be brilliant, and it would be great if you could add some text as well. The more positive reviews, the better chance we have of raising the profile of the podcast and bringing even more great guest content in the future. It will only take a few moments of your time, and we would really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Extended. It's time to talk aviation.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today I'm joined by Tim Robinson, and Tim is the editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, the flagship publication of the Royal Aeronautical Society. Tim, how are you today?
Very well, Peter. Very well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Apologies if the quality of this isn't too great. We're recording in rather remote locations, so I hope this stands up for you. Now, today we want to talk about Ukraine and the evolving situation there. We record this on the 15th of March. So it is an ever-changing situation and things may change before this airs. But we hope to try and get behind some of the facts, some of the fiction, and also some of the thinking of what's evolving from the air war perspective. So, Tim, just before we started, we said, gosh, where do you start with this? Maybe the first place to start is the invasion itself. One of the things I noticed at the start of this is that Russia appeared not to use significant air cover in the invasion itself. How did that manifest itself, and what sort of impact did that have?
So, I mean, at the moment, you know, as you say, it's an evolving situation. This is far from over yet. But I think one of the things that has stunned analysts and people watching this and experts, professionals alike, is that Russia has been unable to, you know, wipe out the Ukrainian Air Force on the ground and wipe them out in the first couple of days. You know, I mean, that was what people were expecting. There was about 300 Russian combat aircraft in theater versus about sort of 96 Ukrainian combat aircraft, fixed wing. So people were expecting that Russia would follow the similar things that we've seen in Iraq or sort of Libya or you know, Western sort of NATO style campaigns. Where there's overwhelming force to destroy your enemy air force on the ground, and then you can move on to attacking ground targets, taking out strategic targets and things like that. They have singularly failed to do that. So there was some tactical and ballistic tactical and cruise missile strikes in the first wave, limiting about 100. That took out things like fixed radars and early warning and things like that, but there wasn't really a kind of a concentrated strike to try and destroy the Ukrainian Air Force on the ground. It seems at least from again, we're looking in from the outside, and outside sources and what's happening on the ground may not be we're not find out until this thing is over. One thing that one thing that you might recall that might have assisted the Ukrainian Air Force, and has actually been backed up by apparently US intelligence, is that they've been very smart in dispersing their forces and kind of operating from austere locations. So you might recall a couple of years ago there was a very famous photograph of a Ukrainian flanker that was operating from a road, and it collected a road sign down the intake. And at the time, people, it was quite amusing, and there's lots of people sort of making jokes about, you know, yes, you know, danger, low flying aircraft and stuff like that. But it's actually it's keeping them alive. It's been keeping them alive. But I think also the fact that the Russians have been able to shut down Ukrainian SAMs. So obviously the surface to air missiles, some of them are large, like S-300s. But some of them are smaller, like Bucks, and they've got a lot of them, Bucks, Manpads. And so the western half of Ukraine really seems to be a bit of a no-go area. And the third thing is pre this conflict, everyone looked around and was taking into account the threat of the S-400 missile system. So this is a... highly deadly, long-range Russian strategic SAM, and it'd be one of the things that they've been worrying coalition pilots in Syria. So people looked at that and they thought, oh, hang on, well, if there's an S-400 in 400 in Crimea, and you've got one in Russia and another one in Belarus, you know, that's most of the airspace covered, you know, so. But I think what's happened there is that the Ukrainians have been smart. They've been flying low. They've been keeping in the ground clutter. So they've been difficult to detect. And secondly, it's just physics, in that the maximum published range of a S-400 is not its effective range. And I think also the Russian SAM operators outside the country have also been worried about friendly fire and fratricide. So they don't want to be lobbing missiles in from long range, and connecting one of their own aircraft. You know, if you're there and you're outnumbering the enemy 3-1, the chances are your SAMs possibly could impact one of your own aircraft, especially if you're flying the same type. So there is that as well.
That's been one of the interesting dynamics of this. If people would allow me to use terminology like that, we don't mean to offend. We're just talking about the air war from an external position here. We appreciate the sensitivities around this. But the Su-27, the Ukrainian Su-27, that was reportedly shot down by an S-400, and that was based in Belarus, wasn't it? And this leads us, I suppose, to understand much more clearly why a no-fly zone is very, very difficult to put up over Ukraine, because not only do you have that long-range coverage from both sides, to be fair, but in terms of potential allied support, for want of a better description, support of the Ukrainians, most of the western airfields are several hundred miles away. So it makes it much clearer why there's a no-fly zone and why everyone's saying it won't work.
Well, not everyone is saying it won't work. So there is some calls. I mean, there's calls from it on the basis of a humanitarian basis. So protect civilians on the ground, debatable, given that a lot of the destruction and death is being caused by artillery. There's calls for it on keeping the West's and sort of NATO's, well, with the West's responses unpredictable, i.e. if you're ruling something out and you're giving your enemy more room to maneuver. And there's also calls for it in that, well, we're in for a penny, in for a pound almost, in that if we are crashing the Russian economy and this is different than previous conflicts, I think, in that the West has been quite open. We are sending lethal equipment, you know, javelins, stingers, and being openly kind of cheering on from the sidelines. So that is quite different to things in kind of previous proxy wars, say for Russia and Afghanistan, where stingers mysteriously found their way to Afghanistan and you know, suddenly Russian gunships were being shot out of the sky. And thirdly, there was one point that was raised, is that which I thought was interesting, is the amount of stealth fighters we have now, the amount of F-35s are in service, gives you an opportunity to basically ignore as much as you can, or negate those S-400s.
Yeah.
So you can actually, you know, if you wanted to, you know, put a barrier around the whole of Ukraine or West Ukraine, or just humanitarian corridors, you know, for kind of airlift, and you could put F-35s in there, or F-22s, and it'd be equivalent to putting a sign on the beach saying, you know, beware of the shark. You've still got the problem, which is what happens if a NATO pilot, you know, comes into, you know, has to shoot down a Russian aircraft, or has to destroy a Russian SAM with Russian operators on there. You know, is this World War III?
Yeah. And Tim, it's almost like a blue on blue, but the use of Russian aircraft on both sides, does anyone have a particular advantage in that? I appreciate that Ukraine lost a lot of their aircraft on the ground early on in some of those cruise missile attacks, but what advantage are the Russians making of the fact that the Ukraine's air force is predominantly Russian built aircraft?
Well, on paper, so again, this is a reversal in fortune. On paper, the Russians should have an advantage because, obviously, they've got some of the latest types that have been deployed. So you've got things like SU-34s, which are, you know, the equivalent to the, you know, the two-seat Strike Eagle. You've got the latest SU-35. So the SU-35 is very, very capable, 4.5, you know, generation fighter. You know, you would think that probably a Eurofighter would give it a hard time, and they've not been able to achieve air dominance, which is, you know, air supremacy or air supremacy. So, there's a little bit of, but also a little bit of confusion from kind of the general public about what air superiority is and what air supremacy is, and there's different levels. So you can have air superiority, for example, over a certain kind of time or space. So for example, large packages at Red Flag, for example, when the US goes out to train at Red Flag, they will saturate the airspace between a certain hours, and they will dominate it by then. But the rest of the time, they'll go home and they won't be contesting it all the time. So, but the presence of these latest aircraft, I mean, what's fascinating as an analyst, or looking from the outside, is that these latest aircraft or platforms they've got, you know, SU-34, I think they've lost about three or four of those. Yeah. And they've been putting dumb bombs on them, you know, and already seem to have run out or getting very, very low on precision guided weapons. They've lost about three or four Ka-52 attack helicopters. So that's like a twin-seat coaxial attack helicopter. And it's got on paper, it's got the latest or the most sophisticated, missile warning and defense.
Yeah, defense suite is very strong on that, isn't it? The Alligator.
Yeah, but if you're flying low level and you're going into manpad threat, and the amount of the amount of stingers and the UK government now earlier this week or a few days ago was talking about sending Star Streaks.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
So, and Star Streaks are, I think, Mach 4 or Mach 5 missile, laser guided, and they can't be jammed by sort of chaff or flares.
Yeah. Yeah, I did see that in the news earlier this week, and I just wondered whether there's also an element in all of this, and again, sitting outside watching in, of the Western nations testing some of this technology and seeing how effective it is against Russian technology.
I don't think we ever doubted it.
I think, but it's interesting to see its use and its effectiveness.
So obviously the you know kind of combat proven kind of badge that people like to, you know, the arms manufacturers or aircraft manufacturers like to have, it's a good thing to have at the air show stands and marketing material and all the rest of it. We've used it, but I don't think there was any particular desire, because it was completely unexpected. I think no one, you know, we were building this up and no one really expected that Putin would take the final step. But having said that, I think a lot of people have come away, especially with things like NLAW, you know, the anti-tank sort of like the weapon, and Javelin. People know about Javelin. Javelin's been proven in Afghanistan, but in Afghanistan it was more used as it was overkill for things like, you know, machine gun bunkers and sangars up on a mountainside and things like that. It wasn't used against tanks. So this is probably ISIS maybe. Javelin's already been proven. Stingers sort of dates back really to the 1980s and the Afghanistan, also Falklands. It was first used in the Falklands. So really the first one, you know, the one that's, I suppose, been a surprise, if you like it, or novel, is NLAW.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, so much still to cover. Just before we go off of some of these military aircraft conflict areas, your colleague Fahad Massoud wrote an interesting article on the Ghost of Kiev. I think this was last week. Has anything further developed on that story?
Apart from I think it was like some kind of selfie, I think, that was released by the Ukrainian MOD and keeping the legend going. No, I haven't seen anything. I mean, what we really want from there is, you know, kind of HUD cockpit camera footage, isn't it, for somebody who is. So I think it's extremely unlikely.
And Tim, just on that whole area of aircraft losses, particularly in the first couple of weeks of the conflict, there were some significant claims about losses. I think the ones on the ground for Ukraine are pretty straightforward. And of course, we saw Mira as well in amongst that. But some of the air-to-air claims were also quite significant. Is there any evidence again coming out of the Ukraine on the accuracy of those, you know, looking at Su-35s, 25s, of course the 27 and a MiG-29?
So again, it's difficult to say. I would imagine and I would suspect that the majority of these are surface-to-air missile kills from the ground. There has been a medal awarded to Su-27 pilot, Ukrainian Su-27 pilot, who I believe got two helicopters and an IL-76 transport. Now the IL-76, there was two apparently reportedly lost, but neither of those been confirmed. So they are still up in the air. But what we do know, so the Ukrainian MOD has been kind of publishing sort of daily the kind of updates on total Russian losses, they claim, and they're saying it's about 77 aircraft and 80 helicopters, which seems on the high side. But what we had in the last 24 hours was the CNC of the Ukrainian Air Force himself. I think he was on Facebook, and he said that was more like 19 aircraft and 20 helicopters, 5 UAVs. That to me sounds a lot more
credible.
A lot more credible. But this is and the Ukrainians, I think they've lost about 9 aircraft and 1 helicopter. So something around those sort of numbers. I mean, this is not a new problem in verifying claims. I mean, you know, people who study World War II histories and things like that as too well. Did Douglas Bader get that measurement, or did somebody else? Where did it go down? Who claimed it? Are people claiming for the same thing? Yeah. There could be ones that emerge after that actually, you know, or that have come down in Russian held areas or Belarus that do turn out to be kills in the end.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, let's move over to civil aviation. I think in the news there's been significant coverage of the civil airliners that are now embargoed and in Russia, but owned by Western leasing companies. And that story rumbles on. The impact of that on particularly the airframers will be significant as well. But on those leasing companies, how do they recover those costs? So I think that's an unfolding story. But sitting behind that, the Russians have now said that they'll re-register these airliners in Russia and continue to operate them. They've said they would go to Asia and places like Turkey for spares. But I noticed that China have said they wouldn't supply any spares for these aircraft. I mean, how realistic for some of these modern airlines, very complex airliners, you know, from Airbus and Boeing, fly-by-wire airliners, how realistic that is that they could keep them flying?
A good question. So,
they're so complex.
The impact on this for Russian civil aviation is immense. I mean, essentially, they're going back to, I think they're even going back to 1991, because I think even in 1991, they had plenty of Tupolevs, Ilyushins.
Much better homegrown.
To rely on. So, essentially now, they're, you know, I don't know, 1945 maybe or something like that. But again, there's a lot of aircraft around. Essentially, they're probably going to be ending up like kind of Iran or North Korea. And Iran obviously has been quite successful in keeping older types and things that you wouldn't, you know, American built aircraft, you know, both military and civil, flying in it for its airline, also sort of kind of sourcing parts on the grey market.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what they're trying to do, you know, cannibalizing. They could probably kind of cannibalize stuff. There's probably a lot of trained engineers to keep them flying for a bit. Obviously trying to source grey parts from somebody who's willing to help. I mean, China turning them down, that's a big... that's a big statement. I mean, there are kind of Russian domestically produced aircraft on the drawing board.
Yeah,
but however, the Superjet, obviously that's got
Western engines. Pratt, isn't it?
Yeah, Safran.
Oh, Safran.
Sorry. And the MC-21, I think, is they were trying to get more and more Russian content on it. So there's sort of some you know, longer term, there is, you know, I suppose they could revitalize their own their own aviation industry. But I think in the short and the medium term, it's going to be very, very difficult. You know, once you've cannibalized stuff, you know. But the other thing is, where are they going to fly them? Because all the airspace is closed.
Yeah, so it'd only be in Turbine, wouldn't it?
Handful, maybe, you know, kind of going to, you know, I don't know, a holiday to Belarus, you know.
And also, in the same way that that affects them, of course, Russian airspace is closed to the rest of the world, almost exclusively. So there is going to be significant changes to some of those long haul destinations, you know, talked about, you know, returning to polar routes and Anchorage and that sort of thing, which I remember as a young person wondering where some of these places were. But it's going to add significantly to other airlines outside of Russia and their logistics as well.
I think you're right. Yes, yeah, definitely. And it's ironic that it comes at a time when, you know, the world is trying to get more efficient, more direct routing to save the environment, you know, to save the planet, save fuel. It's going to add to people's, you know, airlines, fuel bills, you know, to avoid Russia and also to avoid Ukraine and the any kind of overspill that might spread, you know.
One other area of supply chain and logistics that is starting to emerge as well are those nations in places like Africa, some Asian countries that have predominantly Russian military equipment and aircraft. They're going to really struggle with their supply chain issues because some of them come out of Ukraine and a lot of them come out of Russia. So some of those nations like Libya, Central African Republic and places like that that will rely on spares for their aircraft are going to start suffering as well, even though they're supporting or are supportive potentially of Russia. They won't be able to get some of these parts, will they?
I think you're right there. That's going to be definitely going to be more of a challenge to them. And things like, you know, helicopter engines, you know, from Ukraine and things like that. How are you going to get around? I mean, you know, obviously there's ways and means around embargoes and people kind of that's been sort of happened before. But it's so sort of kind of overwhelming and comprehensive this time around that I think, yeah, there's going to be a knock-on effect on, you know, yeah, military sourcing of military equipment, support, and what you have it, what, you know, things like that. I mean, potentially what it'll do is it'll push you know, countries in Africa closer to China, which is already happening.
Well, that'll be an interesting dynamic to watch as well, and hopefully in the next month or so we're going to talk about military aviation in Africa to an expert down there, so we'll hope to ask him some of those questions as well. But let's move on to another area that's been affected by this, and that is aerospace and space. Pat Norris from the Royal Aeronautical Society wrote a great article that's on the Insight blog this week about the impact, particularly on Europe. But let's start off with the International Space Station, the obvious point at which collaboration was so good between Russia and particularly the US. Massive impact on that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, international collaboration in space, it's been one of the you know, one of the kind of a crown jewel in kind of peaceful cooperation for many nations, yeah. And especially with the kind of US and Russia. So it survived the annexation of Crimea. It survived other kind of geopolitical kind of obstacles, and you know, the cooperation there has still been, you know, sort of day-to-day cooperation, day-to-day kind of partnership has still been kind of very good, even when countries get annoyed with each other. However, there has been kind of cracks appearing. So last year, for example, we had the Russians accused, I think it was last year, the Americans of kind of sabotaging. There was some kind of hole that was found on the their part of the station, or the Soyuz rocket, and they were accusing the Americans of sabotaging it. You know, an American astronaut had sabotaged it rather than, I don't know, poor manufacturing or quality control to a Russian factory. And this is now it potentially impacting the ISS. So on the ISS, obviously there's a Russian module, there's the international module, but both, as far as I understand it, are dependent on each other. So the Russian module provides propulsion to lift the station up into a different orbit, but the international module provides power.
That's right.
So you're really dependent on each other in that respect. And in actual fact, I mean, I'm sure that people have already thought about, could you use a SpaceX Crew Dragon to be docked there and do the Russian?
I believe Cygnus has, the Cygnus capsule has been tested. It hasn't been formally adopted, but we I believe Cygnus can actually do the correction burns that are needed. But of course, that then leads to the discussion of how you get Cygnus up there, because there is still, as a result of the sanctions after the Crimea annexation, the sanctions on the use of the RD-180 engines. And although I believe the last six have been delivered to United Launch Alliance for their Atlas V launches, that potentially is it. I know Antares uses the RD-181, and they've got their next two launches next month, and in a year's time they're secured. But of course, that is only dependent upon support, spares, and that sort of thing from Russia. So there potentially is a bit of a challenge there, but I think there's enough scope, particularly for the Americans, to get around it, certainly in the short term. Because I believe Jeff Bezos is his engines will be ready probably next year, by which time the Russian engines would hopefully have been fired off and no longer required.
Extended. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
So I think had this happened a few years previously, SpaceX had got Crew Dragon working, or before SpaceX's Crew Dragon had got its reputation for reliability, then there would have this would have been far harder, and it would have been You know, Russia would have had, you know, the US and kind of ESA over a barrel on this is the only way you're going to get to the ISS via Soyuz.
Yeah.
Now there are much more options. You know, with SpaceX, there's another stuff coming on stream. So and even now, one of the things that strikes me as well is that the Roscosmos holding OneWeb hostage, you know,
the
mega constellation, and also, you know, kind of making these kind of threats against. I mean, I think they seem to be sort of empty threats or kind of social media memes rather than actual serious threats, but. You know, we'll strand a US astronaut in space rather than take him home. I think the latest thing is that they will be taking him home on a Soyuz, a US astronaut. But
Mark van der Hey, he's due back in 2 or 3 weeks' time. I mean, bless him, that'll be an interesting journey that he's got once he's down. I wonder how they'll get him out there, but that'll be interesting. But then after that, I think, as you say, they'll be pretty clear. Just a quick shout out. You mentioned SpaceX there. Quick shout out for SpaceX and, you know, Starlink. They delivered those internet terminals to the Ukraine. Fair dues to them on that one. But some other challenges we've seen, and Pat highlighted in his Insight blog was ExoMars due to launch this year. I think that's certainly not going for another 2 years, having already been delayed 2 years. That was that's the joint ESA Roscosmos program.
That's right. Yeah. So if you miss the boat on that, that's far harder than getting a ride on somebody else's rocket to launch satellites. You know, because you're going to Mars Rosalind Franklin, that was already delayed. You know, that already should have launched, so it's already been delayed, so the launch window there is going to kind of close unless there's sort of some agreement. You know, it might still be able to launch, but it could be as they say, the optics could be tricky.
Yeah,
of a joint European Russian sort of, you know, Mars mission, and also I think it's what one of the interesting things is, I mentioned OneWeb, but you know, as well as Russian civil aviation in crisis, this is going to put the Russian space industry in crisis as well. And they were already kind of bouncing along on the you know, bouncing along on the bottom, really, and kind of scraping around for money, and you know, had ambitious plans for, let's do a joint moon base with the Chinese, let's do this with the China, and a lot of it I seem to be, we have no money, but hopefully let's team up with China, and you know, we'll provide the long term kind of expertise, because we've had all this experience in space, you know, of human space flight, and they'll provide the cash, and we can therefore, you know, Chinese cash and our expertise will unlock, you know, kind of these very ambitious programs, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's just completely you know, probably dead in the water now, and probably also their commercial sort of space flight industry for, you know, Ariane Space has said we're not doing Soyuz launches.
I was gonna say there's obviously the link down in French Guiana, isn't there,
with the sanctions with them holding, you know, OneWeb launch hostage, who now is going to entrust them to you know, and entrust your satellite to a you know, a Soyuz or a Russian launcher, you know, however cheap it might be. So that's interesting as well. But also, I think it's gonna push. You know, it's gonna good news for SpaceX, because obviously maybe more business coming their way. But also, it's going to push countries that factor is going to has woken countries now up to the idea of, oh, hang on, a sovereign space launch capability is maybe not such a crazy idea after all. So the UK space, now obviously we can't, I don't think you'd be talking about launching the entire OneWeb mega constellation from Scotland or air launch from Cornwall. But what it does is it actually makes
it accelerates the potential investment.
Yeah, it throws that into shock relief, and it just reinforces the thing in people's minds that, well, if you don't launch your own rockets, you're at some other country's mercy. And they may decide that they aren't going to do it, or governments may change and things like that. So.
And Tim, just one of the things that's been on my mind is the impact on an organisation like Boeing, who, I mean, there's already been seen to be an interest in raising defence spend, let's just use big air quotes here, in the West quite considerably. We've seen it here, pressure on government already to increase spend on defence areas. I would imagine potentially same sort of pressures in the USA. For a supplier like Boeing, that if it can get its act together on Starliner, and hopefully that will come good. Obviously, seeing them come through the challenges with the MAX, but of course, a massive part of Boeing's income stream is in defence and military areas. How is the defence industry and organisations like Boeing responding or likely to respond to this situation?
Well, I mean, the defence industry is, I mean, I think it's clear that the defence industry military aviation is going to get a massive budget boost from this, from a high-end peer state-on-state war, and seeing what happens if you don't have the right kit. So it's shaken people up and shifted geopolitics in a way that, you know, 2 years ago you would have said that's impossible. So Germany, you know, in the previous president's administration, you know, Trump had come out with all this stuff about, you know, the Europeans being freeloaders, NATO being a waste of space, you know, Germany ought to pay their way.
Yeah,
it's taken this horrific invasion, and Germany now has sort of said, we need to be spending more on defence. We are now going to meet the 2% or even above NATO's minimum of our GDP. We're going to 100 billion into defence, plus we're buying F-35.
Yeah, I know. And a few years ago, it was just unheard of, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, a couple of years ago, there was the head of the German Air Force who got sacked. But he got sacked after publicly saying he wanted the F-35, and the current
administration have basically validated that.
we're taking F-35 because. The geostrategic environment is a lot more unstable and unpredictable and dangerous than we previously thought. Yeah. I think we can say Denmark is going to increase their defence spending.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of Switzerland were all countries that were very, very surprising by their reactions.
Yes. So and places like, you know, Sweden and Finland saying, well, we might like to join NATO as well. I mean, that's a shift, you know. And interestingly, I mean, the So we haven't talked yet about the great Lend-Lease MiG-29, Polish MiG-29 swap.
Well, let's use that as the final parting shot as we leave this discussion, yeah. Tim, because that was very interesting.
So, I mean, one of the things, the interesting things there was it was seemed to have been kicked off a little bit by a statement from the EU saying we're going to supply the, you know, we're going to supply Ukraine with fighter jets. And everyone kind of like, you know, kind of gasped a bit of that and said, well, hang on, EU is not a military organization, so yeah. It'd be their member states. And them sort of saying something this publicly. And what had happened with this is that the State Department had said, this sounds a great idea. We're willing to you know, we'd be willing to approve it. You know, Poland's got this. Bulgaria's got, you know, MiGs as well. Slovakia. Transfer them over. You know, we can approve that. The Ukrainian government obviously had seen this plan floated. They'd been very excited by it, and the parliament had been sort of tweeting, sort of saying, you know, oh, so we've got 70 modern fighter jets coming our way. This is great.
Yeah.
And then the Polish government had said we're ready to transfer. The Polish government had said, well, we're ready to transfer them, but we want F-16s in return.
Right.
You know, to backfill our air force.
Yeah.
So we've got some spare MiGs going. I mean, the Polish Air Force is upgrading to F-16s and F-35s anyway. So they're on the way out. So these aircraft are going surplus. And then they said, oh, we'll transfer them over, but they will transfer them to the US. We'll park them on Ramstein Air Base in Germany. At which point all hell broke loose, and US Pentagon said, this is not a good idea. This is news to us. What seems to have happened was this was a diplomatic or geopolitical hot potato that was passed between NATO members in almost like a farce as to. Everyone knows what the fighters are for. Everyone knows that they're not. You can't supply these things covertly.
Yeah.
But the question is, who wants to be the person that crosses Putin?
Yeah.
And that delivers them over the border.
Yeah.
And is therefore responsible for World War III if he decides that that is a, you know, if he decides that that is a red line.
That's one step too far.
That is, you know, javelins, stingers, anti-tank missiles, ammo, you know, hand grenades, that's fine. A MiG-29, that's too, you know, a kind of
step
too far. So everyone was kind of backing off in a direction away from how you know from proposing this as always a great idea, it being welcomed by the Ukrainians, and then oh dear, this might inadvertently cause World War III. I mean, actually, there is a precedent for that I spotted on Twitter, which someone had pointed out in World War II, in the start of Lend-Lease. So the US hadn't been in
war.
The UK wanted a load of aircraft. But the US had to sort of stay out of it. So what they did is apparently is they took aircraft that we were buying, which I think included things like Lockheed Hudsons and things like that, and some sort of obsolete types. And what they did is they took them to the Canadian border, drained them of fuel, and then the British and Canadians came over and towed them across the border.
I didn't know that with horses
and trucks.
Well, we've seen the Ukrainian farmers using their tractors, so
yeah. It was a fig leaf of respectability to say the US to say we're neutral. We just put them nearby and
yeah.
we're not directly supplying these war machines to you. You know, we're not delivering them. I think probably the so there are ways and means around it, but no one wanted to take that risk.
Right, fascinating. On that note, Tim, let's leave it there. Before we go, where can we find you online, Tim?
Okay, so I am at RASTimR on Twitter. And you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
And you can find me, Peter Johnson, at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter. And you can find Gareth and Ellie on our Facebook, Twitter and Instagram feeds. So that's it. We'd like to thank Peter Dixon and White Hearts for their support in the show. And of course, as always, the wider extended family, including the aviation historian. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a stall being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.